Welcome back to Hino's Home Show. I'm Hino. This right here is my show, and we are brought to you by the folks over at Accurate Mortgage Group. You can find them at accuratemtg.com. If you're looking to buy a house or refinance a house, they'll help you out. They'll get you closed and back to life. Joining me, as always, in the studio is the great Steve Kenny.
Hey, Hino.
How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good. I can't really lie about that. You know, I'm enjoying the nice weather outside and trying to take advantage of that every bit I can get.
You had some fun out on the lake yesterday, didn't you?
I did.
How was that?
It was awesome.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I have had a jet ski for a while and something we've had for a long time. It's an old one. It's not anything fancy, but I got it running this past weekend and then got to take it out on the water for the first time.
I'm a little jealous. I got to say, I'm a little jealous. So yeah, someday if you find it gone from your driveway one day, it's probably me. I got it. You know?
Well, yeah, you know, it reminded me how much I love being on the lake.
Yeah.
You know, not just being on a jet ski, but if you can go at the boat launch I went to, actually was a public boat launch. It's run by, I'm guessing, the state of Tennessee, I think, because it's a park set up. And so there were just a lot of people there swimming and, you know, kind of enjoying the weather and all that. So it was really great. You know, you don't have to have something to go there. You could just go get in the water.
Well, a client that I was working with this last week, they were buying a house on the lake. Ooh. Which was really cool, you know, because they had their own little boat dock and everything. So
yeah.
I saw the pictures from the appraisal. But, you know, it was kind of a tricky deal because, as has been happening a lot lately, they had just gone through a divorce. So so there's just, you know, I don't know what's in the water, but there seems to be a lot of that going on lately. It's like every other client either just got divorced or they're in the middle of a divorce. And it just makes things a little bit more complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, I've noticed a lot of that too. I don't know if it's something in the water or maybe everybody's just trapped at home. And
yeah, I mean, I think people are looking to move a lot now anyway, because they're just sick of looking at the walls that they've been staring at for the last few months.
Yeah.
Being quarantined and everything. But yeah, now they're looking across the other side of the, you know, kitchen table and being like, yeah, and I'm tired of that too.
Well, you know, a few years ago, I think there was a statistic that said you're most likely to get divorced in January.
Really?
Yeah.
January, because of the holidays?
The holidays, yeah. So everybody tries to stay together. You know, it's time to be with family and that sort of thing. So, hey, you know, let's stick this out and let's see how it goes. And if it doesn't go well, well, January, we're going to file for divorce.
New Year's resolution.
Yep, yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I do notice that not all divorce attorneys are equal when it comes to how they structure things and how it ultimately affects their client's ability to purchase a house later on, because that what they do on the front end really affects things on the back end. And I just kind of wish we could, like, you know, sit all the attorneys down and be like, look, if you want your client to be able to buy a house, you need to do these things.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't want it to you don't want them to have to wait 3 years or something to be able to buy another house.
Right. Absolutely. If you're going through a divorce, you know, it would be a great idea to talk to everybody to kind of get your ducks in a row.
Right. Right.
Before you decide on anything.
Like, what are some of the, from the years that you've been doing this, what are some of the bigger things that you've seen divorce attorneys not do what they should have done when it comes to helping their client qualify for a mortgage later on?
So I think the biggest one is alimony and child support.
Yep.
That's usually the biggest exchange on a reoccurring basis. That's the biggest exchange of funds between people. So
especially because that's something that most clients are thinking that we're going to be able to use as income to, yes, be able to qualify them. And depending on how that's set up, we might not be able to be.
Right. Right. So there's this process called a 3-year continuance.
Right.
And essentially what that means for anybody who's listening, it means that we have to show that any income that you're receiving is going to continue for 3 years. Now, with a regular W-2 job or a self-employed job, you know, there's not really any way to prove that other than to say, hey, you have this history of receiving this income.
Right.
So we know it's going to continue.
And it's assumed
forward.
That you're going to keep working at that job.
Right.
Or a better one.
The difference with something like this is it's contractually obligated. And so usually there's a fixed time frame on that.
Right.
It could be based on the age of the children.
And that's the major thing right there. So child support versus alimony. So if the kids are, let's just pick a number, say 16,
yep,
and the support's going to end when they're 18, that's only 2 years.
Right.
So we can't use that.
Right. Exactly.
Because we need to show that it's going to continue for 3.
Right.
So obviously if there's little kids, then that's a whole different ballgame. But
yeah. Yeah. So again, it comes down just to those terms. So You know, something that a divorce attorney, if we were to talk to them, you know, not necessarily us specifically, but if they were to talk to a lender and say, hey, you know, here's what we need to do to help your client get qualified for a house, you could maybe have the younger child, you know, receive a little bit more in child support versus the older one. So that way there's a little bit more income for you to receive over a longer period of time.
Right.
Because also if you have an older child, you know, 16, 17, 18, they're getting ready to go to college. They're still going to have expenses.
Right.
You know,
right.
So they may not be physically living in the house with you, but some of that child support that you receive could go to help them too.
Right. And another thing that they might be able to do, of course, you know, they have to follow the law and everything. But if the kids are, let's say, you know, 16 or 17, maybe weight the amount, the payments more towards the alimony side of things, because right, that won't necessarily end. You could at least make sure that it's going to continue for 3 years versus, you know, hey, next year this kid's 18 and it's over.
Yeah.
You could do that. I know that there are certain guidelines that the state has that, you know, minimum payments and all that sort of thing based on your income. So I'm sure that there's things that they need to take into account that we're not thinking of, but.
Right. Absolutely. Well, and that's why it's a collaborative effort.
What about being on title or not on title? Because I had one borrower not too long ago, they wanted to qualify as a first-time home buyer because they'd never, in their mind, never bought a house before because the house was in the spouse's name. But it turns out that we couldn't do that.
Now, were they actually on title? And here's the reason
why.
They were. Okay. Yeah. So there's a couple of instances that can happen. And, you know, certainly when you're buying a house with your spouse, chances are you're not thinking about divorce. You know, you're
true,
just going, hey.
One,
you know,
would hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Most people look at it and they say, hey, you know, this is our forever home. We're going to be here for 20 years. You know, mm-hmm, that's usually the mindset when you're buying a house. Right. So what'll end up happening is, let's say you've got one spouse who is the breadwinner, or the, you know, the income earner, and then the other spouse stays at home with the kids. Well, what will happen in the state of Tennessee, at least, is the main income earner is going to be on the mortgage, but because you and your spouse are married, you're both going to be on title.
Both on title.
So
right,
even though your name's not on the mortgage, you can't call. I mean, you can make payments. Of course, mortgage company will always accept your payments, but you can't call and make changes. You can't really do anything because your name's not on the mortgage, but you're still on title. So being on the mortgage and being on title are two different things.
Right. And as a side note, that's probably a good advice of any buddy who's got a spouse that's not on the mortgage, is to take the time to set them up as an authorized person on that account.
Yes.
Because we've seen before where, you know, one spouse dies and then the other one's locked out of everything because they weren't on the loan and they won't talk to them.
Right.
And so, you know, you can take the time to just set that up ahead of time so that you're not in that situation.
Yeah, that's really great advice. I'm glad you brought that up. So let's talk about alimony again.
Okay.
You know, we kind of went through some of the scenarios with child support and that sort of thing. Here's what I see happen a lot with alimony. If you've got one spouse who's staying at home with the kids or maybe works a part-time job, they're going to transition and try and get a full-time job now that, you know, they only have one income coming in the house and maybe there's a little bit of alimony coming in. I've seen very frequently that alimony will only be paid for like a year or two.
Right.
And the
right,
purpose for that is, you know, for just that spouse to get back on their feet.
Right. Get through the transition.
Right. Exactly. So if it's less than 3 years, that's not going to be something that we can use. Right.
Right.
Now, another thing to look at too, sometimes, and I've seen this actually, I don't know, maybe 50% of the time, when looking at the way some of these divorces are negotiated, is if the spouse who has to pay alimony has, you know, some reserves or, you know, some savings, I guess, set aside, they will just pay the entire alimony up front. So instead of paying, you know, $1,000, $2,000 a month for 3 years, they're just going to say, hey, you know what? I'm just going to cut you a check for $30,000 right now. Here you go. We're done with alimony. If that happens, we can use those assets to help you, you know, to put towards your down payment, but we cannot use that as income.
Because it's not continuing.
Because it's not continuing.
Doesn't matter that it ends up being the same amount of money in the end.
Right.
The fact that it's not being parceled out in monthly payments for 3 years makes us not be able to use it.
Right, exactly. And there's one additional piece on this too that I want to bring up. depending on the loan program that you do, you know, what you qualify for, you may have to receive that income for a certain number of months. You know, it can be anywhere from three to six months.
Yeah.
Some programs actually require you have to receive it for 12. So that's also another reason why it's very important if you're either looking at keeping the house, you know, the keeping the family house, mm-hmm. or looking at buying a new one, you want to make sure you know what you qualify for on your specific program, because, you know, not only are we going to have to show that 3-year continuance, you're probably going to have to show that you've already been receiving those payments consistently.
Right. And those payments have to be made in the official way. So if the spouse, you know, gives you an extra little bit of money on the side in cash or something like that, we can't count that. It's got to be made as part of the official court ordered, you know, mailed the way they set it up way.
Right.
So what kind of documentation is usually required by underwriters to kind of show all this?
So there's three main court documents. It's going to be the marital dissolution agreement. The marital dissolution agreement is where everyone decides, okay, you know, you're going to get the house, I'm going to get X amount of dollars, blah, blah, blah. Like, it just kind of breaks everything out, right?
Right.
The final decree is where that's actually reviewed and signed off by a judge.
And sometimes people kind of get annoyed that they have to produce their divorce decree as part of the mortgage process, but we need to be able to see if A, you're ordered to pay anything, or if you're going to be receiving anything, and how long that's going to go on for.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, the divorce is like way in the past and we still need to get them to you know, dredge it up and then send it to us. And they're like, why?
Yeah,
that's why. Well, listen, hopefully you don't find yourself in a situation where you're getting a divorce, but if you happen to be, you know, just make sure you check all that stuff out. And it's not a bad idea to have your mortgage person get on the phone with your attorney as you're figuring all this stuff out, just to kind of go over some of those things. Because honestly, a lot of times an attorney isn't really even thinking about you buying another house at some point.
Right.
But it's, you know, more than likely going to happen, because only one of you gets to keep the house and the other one probably wants to get one.
Right.
Right. All right. Well, good. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back with some more of Hino's Home Show in just one moment. Welcome back to Hino's Home Show. I could use a dollar.
Yeah.
Maybe two. Oh, man. Welcome back to the show. We're brought to you by Accurate Mortgage Group. Of course, they're at accuratemtg.com. Give them a shout if you're looking to buy a house or refinance a house. I'm here with Steve Kenny, of course, as always. All right. So speaking of needing a dollar, in our last segment, we were talking about divorces. The number one reason, of course, for getting a divorce is financial problems. Money problems pretty much kills just about any relationship. And many of those end up in bankruptcy, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Which is something that then later on we got to deal with as mortgage guys, because how do we navigate that? How do we get somebody qualified for a mortgage if they've got that in their history? And so I thought, you know, why don't we go over a little bit about what the different types of bankruptcies are, how that might affect you in the future. And, you know, obviously we're not recommending bankruptcies, because if you can avoid a bankruptcy at all costs, try to avoid it.
Yeah.
But if you have no other choice, there's some stuff you need to think about for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and like you said, if you can avoid bankruptcy, highly, highly, highly recommend it. You
absolutely.
Know, it's something that's going to be with you for, you know, 10 plus years.
Years, so. Years and years, yeah. Well, when it comes to the different types of bankruptcies, you know, there's everybody knows about the Chapter 13 and Chapter 7, or maybe they don't know. What would you say is the main difference between those two and how it's going to affect you later when you're trying to buy a house?
So the definitely the more severe one, from a lending standpoint, is going to be Chapter 7.
Right.
And the reason for that is because Chapter 7 is essentially where you go to the court and say, hey, listen, I'm insolvent. I owe a whole bunch of money. I can't pay it back. Please just wipe my debt clean. That's what a Chapter 7 is. So usually, right.
They take a big eraser to your debts and it's gone.
Yep. They add up all your assets, sell everything off, and then the creditors try and fight it out for who gets what. So, you know, that's not really your problem. That's usually the fastest type of bankruptcy. You know, you can go into a Chapter 7 and in 6 months be out, mm-hmm. you know, and have it discharged. Sometimes it can take a lot longer depending on what's all included in that, but it's usually pretty quick and it basically wipes the slate clean. So you get to start over fresh. Now with Chapter 13, so it's a little bit different. That's where you basically go to the court and say, hey, I owe all this money, based on my money coming in and my money going out, I can't pay everybody. I want to pay everybody back, but we need to figure out how to renegotiate the terms so that I can pay everybody
right
back.
So it's kind of a step up from the Chapter 7 because you're still going to make an attempt to repay your debts.
Right.
It's just not going to happen on the schedule that was originally agreed to.
Right. So usually with a Chapter 13, that's going to take a series of years to actually come out of a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. And the reason for that is because you agree with the court how those debts are going to get paid back, and you remain in bankruptcy while you're paying back those
until
debts.
It's done. Yeah, you make your payments actually to the court, right? And then they disperse the money.
Right, exactly. So you just make one payment, it goes directly to the court, they disperse the money to everybody, and so depending on how long it's going to take you to pay that back, that's how long your bankruptcy, your Chapter 13 bankruptcy will last.
Yeah, and that's actually a kind of a point of confusion a lot of times is the date that they entered bankruptcy versus the date that they discharged. You know, I've dealt with people that said, oh yeah, my bankruptcy was back in, let's just say 2010.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but it didn't discharge until last week. So, you know,
right.
But they're in their head, they're like, oh, the bankruptcy ended back in 2010.
Yeah. Now there's one other distinction as well with Chapter 13. You don't see this very often, if ever, with a Chapter 7. There's a dismissed bankruptcy and a discharged bankruptcy. Those are two different things. So with a discharge bankruptcy means that you went into the court, you paid all of your debts, and all right, everybody's settled and it's done.
It's discharged, done, right.
Right? With a dismissed bankruptcy, you basically go to the court and say, hey, I can't pay my debts. I want to pay them back. Let's renegotiate. But the court decides, you know what? You actually do make enough money to pay back this debt. We're not going to accept the terms that you've laid out. We're going to dismiss your bankruptcy. So in that case, it's actually treated a little bit harsher for a Chapter 13. The waiting period before you're eligible to get a mortgage again is a lot longer.
Yeah, it's interesting. Why would you say from a mortgage standpoint that is considered more serious than the first case that we talked about?
So a lot of it has to do with intent, right? So when you go into bankruptcy and the judge says, yes, you qualify for bankruptcy, we look at that as, hey, you got yourself into a mess and you're taking the right steps to get yourself
and you had a good reason to go to the court and ask for this. But in the other case, they're saying, you know what? You're full of it. You can pay this.
Exactly.
And so the intent is you were maybe trying to be deceptive and get out of paying something that you should be able to pay.
Right, exactly. And if you have good attorneys up front, they're going to tell you whether or not, you know, not affirmatively. I'm sure there's some cases where it's uncertain whether or not you qualify, but, you know, a good attorney is going to say, hey, you know, this is definitely something you should look at, or like, you know, you really shouldn't, but if you want me to, like, I'll try and represent you. So it has a lot to do with intent. That's the reason why.
Well, what about if you go to the court and you start the bankruptcy proceedings and then you say, you know what? I've changed my mind. Never mind. Let's cancel this. I'll go ahead and pay everything. Now that's a case where it got started, but then it got stopped. How does that affect things?
Interesting. That actually falls under dismissal as well.
Okay. Even though it was you that decided to dismiss it and not the court.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So in that circumstance, if you somehow, if you go into it, go into bankruptcy and you start making your payments, it's really just better that you finish, you know, because then the bankruptcy will actually be discharged. And if for some reason you have a huge windfall, like you win the lottery or you go gambling and strike it rich, like whatever the case is, it's best that you just go to the court and say, hey, I came into all of this money. I want to pay off my debts, pay off your debts, and then discharge it and then move on.
Right. Rather than dismiss it.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that people are surprised about is that their house, oftentimes their mortgage, doesn't appear on their credit anymore when they go through a bankruptcy. It's like, it's just not there. You know, yeah. It's like, no, I'm making my mortgage payments. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not there.
Yeah. So actually that's a good point, because that is a lot of confusion for some people. So the reason has to do with the way bankruptcy laws work. Essentially, creditors, when you go into bankruptcy, creditors are no longer allowed to directly approach you to try and get their money. You know, normally if you're not in bankruptcy, you miss a payment, they're blowing your phone up.
Sure.
Right?
They're sending you letters, they're calling you, they're texting you, they're doing anything they can to say, hey, we need that money.
Right, exactly. So when you go into bankruptcy, that all stops. The court says, no, if you're trying to get some money, you need to come to the court. The court's basically going to handle that. So likewise with the mortgage, it's going to stop reporting once you enter into bankruptcy, because all of that's being handled by the court, and the court is not going to report that to the credit bureau. So that's usually the reason.
Okay. Okay. Well, one of the things that existed really up until recently is there were some lenders out there that would do a mortgage pretty much like a day after you got discharged from a bankruptcy. Now, the downside, of course, is that you're going to end up paying a much higher rate, and the terms are much harsher than they would be if you just were getting a regular mortgage. But for some people, that was a possibility. But that's not around anymore, is it?
No. No, there's been a lot of changes recently, as I'm sure everybody's aware, not just to lifestyle, but also to, you know, the lending industry and pretty much every industry out there, I feel.
Yeah, like, I mean, like even here in Nashville, there's a couple companies that we're aware of that actually went out of business. They're just gone.
Right.
As a result of this whole COVID thing and all the different mortgage changes and the regulation and guideline changes, they just stopped.
Yeah. Now, what you're talking about, this specific type of lending, it's a very, very small portion of the market. It's called non-QM. And QM stands for non-qualified mortgage.
Right.
So I want to take a step back and kind of explain where that verbiage comes from, because this is kind of a new thing. So if you go back before 2008, there was prime lending and then subprime lending.
Right.
Right? Subprime has become a dirty word.
It was.
Yeah.
But pretty much anybody could get a subprime loan back in the day.
Yes.
No job, no problem.
Right. Exactly. So prime essentially means like, hey, you know, this is someone who qualifies for a mortgage. You know, they meet every single one of the pieces of criteria. Subprime meant, hey, they've got some good things, but they've got some bad things, but we're willing to give them a loan anyway, right? You know, everybody right. deserves a chance at home ownership. So in 2008, when the market crashed, and then subsequently in 2009, 2010, when all these new bills got passed by federal Congress, one of the changes that they made was to create this thing called a qualified mortgage. And essentially, qualified mortgage meant someone qualified for the mortgage, hence the term.
Right.
And they met all of that criteria.
Right. Because as loan officers, we are required to make sure that the people we're lending money to can actually afford that mortgage, have the ability to repay. And so there's all the guidelines that they, and if all those guidelines are met and we check off all the boxes, that's a qualified mortgage.
Right, exactly. Now, there's a section after that that's about non-qualified mortgages. So this is where someone doesn't meet all of those specific things. The lender is actually going to shoulder more responsibility if you default. So that's kind of the difference between QM and non-QM. You know, why is that important? Well, non-QM lenders are the ones that will give you a loan one day out of bankruptcy. Now, most mortgage companies, and again, this is just kind of reflective of the market at large, you know, 97, 98% of the market is all QM stuff.
Right.
You know, non-QM is a very, very small portion.
Very small. And they have, since the whole COVID thing, pretty much gone away.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they're coming back. I'm sure they'll come back at some point. So if you just got out of a bankruptcy, you know, 2 weeks ago, you're going to have to wait a while.
Yeah.
And typically, depending on the loan program, it's anywhere from 2 to 4 years, depending on which type of bankruptcy that you did, 7 or 13, and which loan program we're talking about, whether it's conventional FHA or VA or USDA, it's going to be anywhere from 2 to 4 years that from the date of discharge.
Right. Right. And actually, another piece to add into this too, speaking about homes specifically, if you were to just foreclose on a home, which basically means like, hey, you know what? I don't want to pay the mortgage anymore. You give the keys back to the bank is a term that people used to use. If you foreclose on a home, you have to wait 7 years before you can get another mortgage if you're going to go conventional.
Right.
There's other loan types that are a little bit shorter. It's 3-4 years, depending. If you include the mortgage or the house in a bankruptcy, that time frame actually gets shortened down to meet the bankruptcy requirements.
All right. Well, hopefully you don't find yourself in a situation where you're even thinking about bankruptcy. But if it's something that you do find yourself in, we wish you the best of luck. If you want to call us and talk to us about the ramifications of some of the things that you're thinking about, you know, we're happy to talk to you about that. Or if you've got one that's in the past that you're ready now to look for a house or refinance a house, we'll be happy to help you out with that as well. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back with more of Hino's Home Show.
I ain't rich, but I damn sure wanna be. Yeah, working like a dog all day ain't working for me. I wish I had a rich uncle that would kick the bucket. Now we're sitting on a pile like a Warren Buffett. I know everybody says money can't buy happiness. It could buy me a boat. It could buy me a truck.
Yes, it can.
It could buy me a Yeti
Welcome back to Hino's Home Show. Yeah, money can buy you a boat, all right.
Buy you a lot of things.
Buy you a lot of things. Actually, a lot of people have been refinancing lately to buy a boat. Yeah. That's been like I've been hearing that a lot lately. It's like that now that summer's here and we're finally able to get out and about, you know, people are like, that's it. I'm going out to the lake. Well, you were just doing that a couple of days ago.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, it's funny. Actually, last night I was looking at boats for sale.
Okay. All right. What kind of boat would you get if you could get one?
So I was looking at pontoon boats, and because we're big fans, we go out on the lake, like we just kind of anchor up and like jump in the water and swim and do all that kind of stuff. So we were looking at pontoon boats, but there's actually a thing called the Nashville Boat Club.
Right. I've looked into that.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Essentially, you become a member of this boat club and they have, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 boats, something like that. You put in a reservation for when you want to go out. You just pay your monthly fee and then you show up, get on the boat. They push you out. You come back and they take care of the rest.
Yeah. And you can pick a pontoon boat this time, a ski boat the next time, or a fishing boat another time. So it's kind of like having many boats, but
yeah, exactly.
Probably for less than it would cost to own one boat.
It is a lot less. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're looking for a way to buy that boat and get some money to do it, there's some ways you can do that. How does that relate to your mortgage is probably what you're thinking.
So there's this thing called a cash out refinance, and it's pretty much exactly like what it sounds like. You are pulling cash out of the equity of your home so that you can use it to buy a boat.
Right.
Or buy a pickup truck.
Or pay off credit cards or whatever it is that you need to do, or add on a deck or a swimming pool or something like that.
Right, exactly. So the equity in your house is your money, you know, so you're basically just borrowing your own money. If you're going to do a cash out refinance, you know, you're not borrowing additional funds from a bank and it just kind of sits out there as an additional debt. It's your money that you've built up in equity, whether the home is appreciated or, you know, you've just paid down the mortgage because you've been in it for a while. So that's an asset of yours that you can pull against, you know, to buy a boat or do whatever kind of things you want. A lot of people are doing it to renovate their house.
That's one of the benefits of being in an area where property values continue to go up, because it enables that kind of thing. Obviously, if your property values go down, then you're kind of out of luck in that area. But we're very lucky here in Nashville that by and large, property values have been going up pretty steadily.
Yeah, absolutely. And it definitely helps too that rates have been low and people have been taking advantage of that. And one of the ways that you can actually take advantage of the lower rates is we're doing a lot of cash out refinances for people where their rate right now may be 4-4.5%, and they're getting a lower interest rate on the debt they already owe.
And getting some cash out.
And getting cash out, yeah.
And sometimes keeping their payment about the same or maybe even a little bit lower.
Right.
Because the rates are so much better. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it doesn't make sense to do a cash out refinance. I mean, if you're looking to do a refinance and you're not planning on staying in the home for very long, maybe a year or two or something, it might not make sense.
Yeah.
But if this is going to be a house that you're going to be in for a while, then at least a few years, then it might make sense to do that, especially if you've got some burning desire to you know, add on to it or get a boat, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now, if you are, so let's say you're in that scenario where you're planning to sell your house in a year or two, maybe you've got some additional debts or things like that. There's actually some ways that you can use the house to your advantage to help you qualify for the next house. Here's what I mean by that. So if you were to do a cash out refinance and you're going to sell the house in a year, like you said, really doesn't make a lot of sense. And I agree with that. You know, unless you really need the money right that moment, probably not going
to
make a lot of sense.
Like in order to fix it up so that you can sell it.
Exactly.
Maybe that would be a good idea.
Yeah, that's a good example. And even then, there may be some other things that you could do, but that's, you know, getting into specifics with people. So if you have that question you want to talk about it, call us. But if you are planning to pay off a bunch of debt using the equity of your house, you can sell your house, pay off your debt, and then when you go to buy the new one, we recognize that you've paid off all of that debt.
Right.
So that way you're not incurring the extra cost of doing the cash out refinance when you know you're going to sell in a year. Just sell the house, pay off the debt, and then also use money as a down payment on the new house.
Yeah. Sometimes people, I do come across this sometimes when people are looking to consolidate debts and we're going through all their credit cards. All right, we'll pay this one off. Every once in a while, they'll be like, no, don't touch that one. That one's at 0% interest. So I don't want to pay that one off. And I know what kind of fine print those 0% credit cards have. Credit cards are in the business of making money, you know, so they have stuff built in there where, like, you know, you're a nanosecond late on your payment one month. you know, they charge you all the interest that you would have paid right back to the beginning of that thing. And it's usually at like some super huge rate, like, you know, 20, 30% or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
So I'm really reluctant to tell people, you know, yeah, okay, just leave that one alone. It's like, man, you really should, you know, now that the rates are so low on mortgages, you really should take advantage of that and get rid of that thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and a lot of this you have to look at from a practical standpoint too. So just because your rate's 0%, if it's only 0% for another 6 months and you're not going to pay it off in 6 months, well, you're going to have to do something about that debt.
Right.
So even though you may be going from paying 0% interest to paying, you know, I don't know, 3, 4, 5% interest, depending on what you qualify for and all those other factors that go into it, it can still make more sense because now you're committed to making that payment. And you're also consolidating all of your debt under one umbrella. So you're only making one payment instead of, you know, writing out 10 checks to 10 different credit card companies.
Right.
You know, that can make your life a lot more simple. You're less likely to get a late payment, which is going to kill your credit. And that's ultimately going to make your life a little bit more simple. Now, also, along with that comes cash flow. We've talked about doing cash out refinances in the past to help people save money on a monthly basis. Well, you may be paying the same interest rate on whatever debt and also on the new mortgage. And you say, hey, well, why would I do that? Like, I'll just keep this one separate. But now you've got less money going out every month, and that's going to give you some breathing room to build up emergency funds and things like that.
Right. And typically mortgages are amortized over a much longer period of time than most consumer debt. You know, most consumer debt's not amortized at 30 years, for example.
Right.
So, and the longer it's amortized for, the lower the payment. So it can help you out in that way. And, you know, not the least of which, being able to write off your mortgage interest, you know, of course there's, you know, consult your CPA because there's different, you know, guidelines about what you can write off and what you can't. But in general, mortgage interest, or at least some of it, is tax deductible, whereas none of your credit card interest is tax deductible. You know,
right.
or on a second mortgage or a home equity line of credit or that kind of thing. Speaking of which, you know, what would you advise the difference is between, you know, doing a straight up refi where you're pulling cash out versus getting a home equity line of credit?
You know, that's actually a really good question. So I do have this conversation with people on kind of a regular basis. And here's the best way to look at the difference between doing a cash out refi versus a line of credit. A line of credit is basically a credit card.
Yep.
With a lower interest rate.
And tied to your house.
And tied to your house. Yeah. So if interest rates go up, your home equity line of credit rate is going to go up.
Yeah.
They're usually only fixed for a certain period of time. And it's usually like the first year, mm-hmm. you know, so you get that introductory rate, maybe it's 3% or 4% or whatever it is. But then every year after that, it's going to go up or down based on what interest rates do.
Right. And the other thing is that a mortgage is based on simple interest, whereas most of the time, a home equity line of credit is compound interest. The way I look at it is you're basically paying interest on your interest because right. every day they add a little bit of interest to your balance. And so the next day, your balance is a little higher and the interest gets added to that. And so it just, you're constantly, the balance is growing throughout the month and you're continually paying a little bit more interest, a little bit more interest every month or every day until the month is over and your payment is due. And so you're basically, you know, you're renting that money.
Right.
And if you make the minimum payment, kind of like a credit card, you're not going to be paying it off anytime soon.
Yeah.
Another thing that the difference between a purchase loan and a refinance loan, on a purchase, everybody knows you can't roll in your closing costs. You know, you had to bring a check to closing when you bought the house.
Right.
But on a refinance, you can actually roll your closing costs in and have it be part of the new loan. So typically you can do the refinance for little to no cash out of pocket, just depending on you know, whether you need to pay for the appraisal or not. So that's a major difference that if you've never done a refinance before, that most people, you know, might have in their head that, oh, it's going to cost me all this money that I have to write a check for. More than likely, you won't have to.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And one additional thing I want to add in there for people too is if you have, let's say you have multiple liens on your house, or maybe you already have a first and a second mortgage, or you bought a pool and there's a lien against your house for the pool until you pay off the pool guy.
Mm-hmm.
Any liens that are on title are gonna have to be paid off when you do a cash out refinance.
That's right. Including ones that you may have forgotten about.
Yes.
You know, we call them silent seconds or UCC loan for like home improvements and, you know, energy efficient windows and that kind of thing. A lot of times there's this second that's been filed on the property, and there's no payments or anything like that. And so people forget about them, like a THDA loan, for example.
Yep, that's a great example.
But, you know, years later, you go to refinance, and it's like, oh, yeah, I got to pay that back.
know? Right, absolutely. So I say that to say, if you're looking at pulling cash out, know how much you owe on those liens on your house. And if you don't know, we can help you with that. But that's something to take into consideration. If you have a lien hanging out there, it's got to be paid off.
All right. Well, listen, I'm going to go boat shopping here during the next break. We got to take a break, but I'm going to go see what kind of boat you were looking at and see if that's something that might interest me. We'll be right back here on High Nose Home Show. Welcome back to High Nose Home Show. We are brought to you by the good folks over at Accurate Mortgage Group. You can find them at accuratemtg.com if you're looking to buy a house or refinance a house. Definitely help you out. Well, we've been getting a lot of listener questions over the old emails and Facebooks and that kind of thing, so we thought we'd answer a few of them today. See what's in the old mailbag. Steve, what do we got in there?
All right, so first question's coming from Tina in Franklin. What's the deal with jumbo loans? I heard most lenders weren't offering them lately, but now I hear some are. And what constitutes a jumbo loan anyway?
What's the deal? Yeah, I do a terrible Jerry Seinfeld, but that would be the perfect spot for him to say, what's the deal with jumbo loans?
You're right. I didn't pick up on that, but that's great.
So jumbo loans are, you know, by definition, bigger. They're bigger loans. So Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, with the guidelines that they have, there's certain loan limits that they have put in place that vary by county around the country. But, you know, around here, most of the counties, there's $510,400 is the limit to how big a Fannie Mae conforming loan can be.
They couldn't just make it $510,000?
I don't know why. It's $510,400. And then when you get a little bit bigger than that, it becomes a high balance loan up to about 700,000, 734, I believe.
Depending on the number of units and depending on the county.
That's right, yeah. Depending on the county. And then anything bigger than that, it's a jumbo loan. So if you're dealing with, you know, the houses that we see in Brentwood and Bellmead and places like that where we're talking millions of dollars, you're more than likely looking at jumbo loans. And like so many other things that happened recently with the whole coronavirus thing, those went away for couple of months. So if you were needed to refinance and you had a jumbo sized loan or buy a house and you didn't have enough of a down payment to make the loan amount smaller than a jumbo loan, you were basically out of luck for a temporary while anyway. But just now, just recently, they're starting to come back. So they're coming back and we're able to do them again, which is nice. So that's what a jumbo loan is. And yes, we can do them now. All right, Steve, let me throw one at you here from the mailbag. We got Sarah from Smyrna says, I just moved to Middle Tennessee from Las Vegas, and I'm used to about 30% humidity. And I definitely notice the difference here, but my neighbors say it's nothing. So now I'm nervous. What am I in for, and how long is it going to take me to get used to it? That's interesting. Well, both of us moved here from other states.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is a good question, and this one's actually kind of near and dear to my heart. And you know,
your armpits.
Yeah, my armpits. Yeah, yeah. I'll put some cards on the table, so to speak, since you're from Vegas. So, I actually suffer from eczema, which is really, really dry skin. So, you know, other than just dealing with some discomfort and things like that, it doesn't really affect my life. So I've been fortunate in that regard. Well, humidity is good for people with dry skin. Okay. It's actually good for everybody to some extent, but it's really good for people with dry skin. Now, when I go out to Vegas, because we live here and it is humid, my skin dries out real fast. So I actually prefer to be in humidity like this. But like you said, we're both from different states. We both moved to Tennessee. So I'm not a doctor. I can't really speak to how long it's going to take you to adjust to the humidity, but I can tell you what my own experience was like. So I moved from the north, upstate New York, where the winters are very cold and very, very dry, right? So in the wintertime, my skin would flare up. It was awful. Well, I went to school. I went to the University of South Carolina. So I moved to a place that's very, very humid. It took me a solid year to adust to it. I mean, the first 6 months, I sweated all the time, everywhere. It was awful. I'm not going to lie about that. But from 6 months to a year, I started to adjust to it a little bit. And after a year, I actually preferred being in the humidity.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just, everybody's going to be a little bit different, but, you know, give it a year and you're probably going to be real comfortable and actually enjoy it.
But you definitely will adjust. I mean, there's no question about that. So I move here. It's been, gosh, about 20 years now, but I moved here from California originally, where if it got below 60, everybody was reaching for their ski jackets. I mean, it was, you know, it was like that was considered cold, you know?
Yeah.
And it was about probably about a year and a half in. I went out one morning to get the paper back when people still got newspapers. And I was just wearing shorts and a t-shirt. And I realized halfway through my walk up the driveway that it was like 30 something degrees. And I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt and I was okay. And I was like, wow, I would not have done that 2 years ago because, you know, I would have bundled up head to toe to go out and get that newspaper. So you definitely will get used to it, you know. So
Yeah. And you made a good choice moving to Middle Tennessee. You
know, absolutely.
I haven't been here as long as you have, Hino, but I got to tell you, like, I never thought I would live in Tennessee ever in my life. And then I moved here and I love it. So
yeah.
You made a good choice.
What I like about it is that we have basically all four seasons, but none of them are super extreme. You know, our winters aren't anything like what you'll find in Chicago or some of those places. Our summers are nothing like you'll find in like Atlanta or New Orleans, you know?
Yeah.
So that's my 2 cents right there. All right, what else we got in the mailbag there?
All right, so we got another mortgage question. So okay. Mike from Antioch says, my neighbor and I both refied and have basically the same house and similar income. Why did we get different rates? Did one of us get raked over the coals?
Good question. No, probably not. The thing about mortgage rates is that they do differ by the individual because everybody's situation is slightly different. And I think the common misperception is that rates is what changes all the time. And that's really not what changes. The rates are what they are. They you know, go from, you know, 2% to 10% in eighth increments all the way up the chart. But what changes is the pricing for those rates. You know, what that rate is going to cost a particular borrower versus another borrower. And your credit score, your debt to income ratio, the loan to value on the property, the loan program that you're doing. There's a whole bunch of variables that all decide what the pricing is going to be for a particular loan for a particular borrower. So since kind of like fingerprints, no two people are exactly alike, chances are that even though you're refinancing the almost same house right next to your house, chances are the rates are going to be a little bit different just because your personal situation is different from your neighbor's.
Yeah. Listen, that's actually a really great explanation. And I do want to add one thing though.
Yeah.
Let's say everything was the same. You owed the same, house was the same, income, all that stuff. Everything was exactly the same.
It was your twin. It was your financial twin. Yeah.
That's a great way to look at it. Your neighbor may have paid points to get a lower rate.
Right.
He's not telling you he paid points.
That could be too.
You know, a lot of people, because I hear this every once in a while, you know, people want to talk to me about mortgages, you know, just because I'm in the mortgage industry.
Right.
Like, hey, what are rates doing? That is something that I always notice. People will never actually tell you.
Right.
So even if everything's exactly the same, there could be a reason that has to do with them having a different rate because they paid a little bit more money to get it.
And on a side note, actually, that is a question that does come up is it worth paying points? And I guess, you know, that depends, again, on mainly how long you're planning on being in the home.
Yeah.
Because buying down the rate could be very beneficial if the savings is enough that you can break even on that within a couple of years. If you're going to sell the house in a year or two, it might not be worth buying down the points. Because that's one of the things that surprises a lot of people is that when we're down at these really low rates right now, and if you're dealing with a loan amount that's kind of on the small side, the difference in payment between, you know, I don't know, let's just say 3% versus 3.5% is really not that big of it. I mean, it's very, you know, 20, 30 bucks maybe, you know, so it may not be worth buying the rate down if you look at it that way. But if you're dealing with a bigger loan amount, you know, each little fluctuation in rate makes a big impact on your payment. So in that case, it could be worth it. So again, it's totally dependent on your personal situation.
Yeah.
And what you got going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that makes me think of like old wives' tales. So when I first got in the business 10 years ago, I had several people say to me, I've always been told if I can't lower my interest rate 2%, it's not worth it to me. I'm like, okay, well, I mean, if that's how you feel about it, that's how you feel about it. Then eventually, as years went on, it became, well, if I can't lower my interest rate 1%, it's not worth it for me. Here's what I want to tell people who hear that. If you're thinking 2% and then it became 1%, eventually it's going to become 0.5%, right? Where that comes from is because mortgages 20, 30 years ago were a lot smaller than they are now.
Right.
So on
a the rates were a lot higher. So you were talking like the difference between 12% and 10%, you know?
Right, exactly. You know? So when you're talking about bigger and bigger mortgage sizes, the percentages may be smaller, like the difference between the rates, but on an actual dollar standpoint, it can make a big difference.
That's true. That's true. All right, reaching into the mailbag here, we've got Annie from Kingston Springs says, a lender told me it was okay to pull my credit because somebody else already did. Is that true?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely, it's true. There's something that the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, put in place, and that's basically applies to mortgages in particular. When you do a credit inquiry for a mortgage, it opens up what we call a 45-day shopping window where you can pull credit for a mortgage as many more times as you want, and only that first one is going to affect your credit in any way.
Yeah. So the reason this rule came about is because prior to 2008, when a whole bunch of changes happened, people felt like they were getting ripped off, right? Mm-hmm. You know, okay, the lender promised me something in the beginning, and then once I got to closing, it was completely different, but they pressured me into doing it anyway, right? So, you know, those are some of the horror stories you hear. I've never been involved in anything like that, but, you know, I've heard stories.
We've heard the stories.
Yeah. Right. So what the CFPB and the legislators who ultimately put the CFPB into place, they put in this shopping window so that people had an opportunity to talk to a couple of different lenders to make sure that they were getting a good deal.
Right. So without the fear of destroying their credit in the meantime by having different people look at it.
Exactly. Yeah. So this was purely meant to protect the consumer. That's the only reason. And so I know it sounds a little bit fanciful, you know, if you've never heard of that before, but it's actually there to protect you. So it is a good thing.
Well, that's about all we have time for on this mailbag. But if you've got a question, we'd love to hear it. You can go to heinoshomeshow.com, shoot us your question or show topic idea. We'd love to hear from you. Or if you just want to schedule time to come in and meet with us and talk about your mortgage or refinance options, we'd love to talk to you. Also, just want to give a quick shout out to our producer, Ellen Sevier, does a great job for us. So thank you for all you do. We'll see you next week on Heino's Home Show.